This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The World Series continues tonight with Game 3 in Philadelphia. What better time to wax poetic and complain about baseball? You probably know my guest Bill Littlefield as a sports commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. He has a new book called Baseball Days, From the Sandlots to the Show, that celebrates baseball and all its manifestations. Littlefield also has a new book for young people called Champions, profiling 10 athletes. I asked him who he's rooting for in the series.
I find that I'm split on this, Terry. My heart is with the Phillies. Unfortunately, my head is telling me that the Jays will probably prevail.
You think they're the better team?
Yeah, I think pretty much down the line they're the better team. They're the better dressed team. They're the better shaven team. All those things.
Do you like to see the better team win or your favorite win? I mean, do you think there's a certain order that prevails when the better team wins?
Well, when we get into the postseason and the Red Sox aren't involved, which is much more often than not, I root for the game itself. I root for good baseball, and that means I root, in the case of the World Series, for a 7-game series with lots of drama building toward the end. And so that's what I'm hoping for this time, too.
Do you think that each of the teams kind of epitomize a different baseball style?
Well, the players on the team certainly present themselves that way. The Phillies seem to be so determined to present themselves as the team of character and the team that's a throwback to the old days where you only had one pair of pants, so when it ripped, you couldn't change it. You know, John Kruk had 3 pairs of pants in his locker that night of the last game of the playoffs, so he could have changed his pants. And I was a little surprised to see that he had a clean pair on once the series began.
The Toronto Sun is promoting the series with a cartoon image of a player called Fat Phil. That's P-H-A-T, Fat. And he's a pot-bellied, bearded batter weighing himself on a scale. And, of course, the scale is busting because he's so heavy. Do you see Kruk as a kind of throwback to the Babe Ruth days of athletes where people were kind of, you know, some athletes were pot-bellied but still played a good game?
Yeah, sure. And it's not only to Babe Ruth. It was much more contemporary player. Yogi Berra said, it's a good thing you don't hit with your face because I would have been in trouble.
Is it my imagination or is there more spitting than usual during this series?
It's either that there is more or that the cameramen and camerawomen have decided to focus on it more frequently. I think there's a certain perversity operating. They not only are catching people spitting all the time, they're also catching poor Jim Fregosi smoking in the dugout. And I think there may be some in-joke among the technicians or something.
Tonight, the designated hitter rule won't be in effect because they'll be playing at the Phillies' home stadium in the National League. And The Blue Jays lead pitcher said that he swung the bat only 3 times since high school. He says, I haven't seen a pitch since 1986. If I make contact tonight, I'll be happy. What impact do you think it'll have on the game to be playing without the designated hitter rule tonight?
Well, the American League is at a disadvantage, of course, because they are accustomed to the designated hitter, and their teams in the American League are built around the opportunity to use the designated hitter. I'm actually one of the very few people who follows baseball who's in favor of the designated hitter rule, and I recognize that it takes strategy out of the manager's hands, but I appreciate it because it gives old guys an opportunity to keep playing, and I wouldn't be still playing fast-pitch softball in Cambridge if there were no designated hitter rule. I can still limp to the plate and hit the ball, and we have this situation where sometimes we do a kind of a relay race, and somebody jumps in halfway down the first baseline and runs for me.
What seems to you to be the best stories to have emerged so far from the first 2 games of the World Series?
Oh, I think one interesting story is that starting pitching hasn't been the story at all. You know, the old chestnut wisdom in baseball is that starting pitching, good pitching always beats good hitting. And the starting pitching has been very disappointing, I think, for both sides. So that kind of throws the whole thing up for grabs. And I suppose that works finally in Philadelphia's favor. If the series becomes unpredictable, then the unpredictable team is most likely to prevail.
Bill, how do you like staying up past midnight to watch a game?
I don't. That's one of my gripes. I really look back with nostalgia to the days of day baseball, even in the postseason. I remember I used to have, when I was in elementary school, a World Almanac, which I had cut the center out of, and I had a little transistor radio built in that I could fit into the almanac and used to hold the almanac to my ear in the corridors in school. We weren't supposed to have radios, of course, and I could keep track of the World Series that way. That kind of mischief, it seems to me, was a pretty important part of of growing up. And kids now, my gosh, you know, they're so sleepy. If they do stay up and watch the World Series, they probably miss school altogether. I think they would be better off with the portable radios listening to afternoon games.
In your career, you haven't done daily sports writing. You haven't written for a daily, or you haven't written regularly for a daily. The kind of writing where you're commenting on games day by day and you're going into the locker rooms to do the post-game interview. Why haven't you done that particular brand of sports writing?
Well, the short answer is that nobody's asked. The long answer is that if I can avoid it, I would prefer to. The closest I ever came to writing about sports as a beat man was during the playoffs in the World Series in 1986, when the Red Sox made it to the playoffs and then subsequently to the World Series against the Mets. And it was extraordinary for me because my wife had just given birth to our first child. So at home, we had a screaming baby who was waking up at all hours to be fed, and I was getting home at 3 a.m. from games, which, like the games in the World Series going on right now, were ending far too late. And then I had to, as you say, go into the locker room, do all the interviews, truck the tape around, and file the story. And I came out of that experience wondering how anybody does it. And I didn't even have to go to the second city. I was only covering the games in Boston, so I didn't have to go to New York when the game shifted to Shea Stadium. I really prefer an opportunity to sit and think a little bit and work more sane hours. And as long as I can make the nut doing it that way, I'll continue doing it.
When you were doing the locker room interviews in 86, was there a feeling of pointlessness about it, in the sense that you knew that they weren't going to really tell you anything?
Well,
anyways,
that's part of the pointlessness, but that's only the tip of the iceberg of pointlessness. Believe me, one of the most awful things that happened to me in that series was I went into the New York locker room, and at one point, and there was a pitcher sitting there with a giant ice bag on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the National League players. You know, I don't follow the National League regularly all year. I'm an American League guy in an American League city. So I see this guy with his giant ice pack on his shoulder, and I went up and I started asking him about the game as if he were the pitcher who had just, you know, come out of the game, because he did, after all, have this huge ice pack on his shoulder. And it turned out that he hadn't pitched that night at all. And he looked at me for a while I went on with my dithering, silly question, and then he gave me a response which I can't repeat on the radio, and basically told me that probably I'd gotten my press credential out of a cereal box and should go somewhere else. I'm not crazy about working in locker rooms.
How did you feel after that? Were you very
awful.
Embarrassed?
Yeah. I was hopelessly embarrassed. The only thing that I was thankful for was there wasn't anybody else around to hear it. You know, nobody was paying too much attention to me because they were all too busy asking the players what pitch they had hit and whether they had a chance to come back and win three in a row or whatever else predictable questions they were asking in order to get their predictable answers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Littlefield, and he's a sports commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He has two new books. One is called Baseball Days, From the Sandlots to the Show. He also has a new book of profiles of athletes written for young people, and that book is called Champions. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about baseball, back with Bill Littlefield. Bill, you did a commentary on Morning Edition back when the Seattle Mariners were up for sale, and you suggested that you should buy the team, and with the help of listeners who should send in $2 each. And
right.
I loved your suggestions of how you should rename the team and what the team, how the team should be changed. You want to go over that with us?
Sure. It was my my soupy sales impersonation on radio.
Oh, right, get your mom to, yeah.
Scrape the change off your dad's bureau, put it in an envelope, and send it to me. What I said was that the Mariners were available for $100,000, but times being what they were, I thought probably the owner, Jeff Smullyan, would take $89.9, and with the help of the listeners, I thought probably I could scrape the down payment up. And numbers of people did send in money.
I think one of my favorite suggestions was that you swore you would trade any player who referred to himself in the third person.
Yes.
Why? That's the thing with politicians and athletes that I really don't understand. What is behind this phenomenon?
I think if you talk to the players, the guy who did it when he was here in Boston was Wade Boggs. And when he would go into a slump, which was rare because Wade Boggs was and still is a wonderful hitter, you'd talk to him and he'd say, "That was not Wade Boggs up at the plate today." And you'd pause and then you'd say, "Well, who was it?" He had your uniform on, Wade. You know, if you ask them why they do it, and some people used to ask Boggs why he did it, and he had this feeling that, in fact, it was a way to express his humility, that it was a humble way to refer to himself. He didn't want to say, I, so he called himself Wade Boggs. And, of course, the effect was precisely the opposite of what he apparently had intended.
So, Bill, what did you do with the money that the listeners had sent you to help you buy the Seattle Mariners?
I signed all the checks and sent them to the Boston Food Bank and wrote letters to all the people who wrote in and told them that their money had gone to help feed people who might not otherwise be fed and that they should all take an appropriate tax deduction. Needless to say, we didn't have enough to make even a vaguely credible offer to the Mariners. I think we came up with about $60 after this campaign.
Right. Now, you've been writing about sports for a while. Were you an athlete when you were young?
That's the charitable interpretation of what I did. I played well enough to have a good time playing a lot of sports, but nobody ever confused me for a prospect. There was no possibility I'd ever be mistaken for one. But I loved the game, and I played all the time. And when it was winter, I played basketball and hockey. And when it was spring, I played baseball and played all summer and enjoyed it and still play. And I think one of the nice things about baseball is you don't have to be terrifically talented and gifted in order to go out and have a great time throwing the ball around and hitting it and playing the game.
Your brother played in the minor leagues for a year.
My brother-in-law, yes.
Oh, brother-in-law.
My brother-in-law, yes. He played in the Minnesota Twins organization, dropped out of college to play for 1 year, and has never regretted it. And as a matter of fact, we had a conversation. What I laughingly refer to as research for this book, Baseball Days, involved going to a lot of baseball games, some of them minor league games in great minor league parks, beautiful places. And one night, my brother and I went to the AA ballpark in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is on an island in the middle of the Susquehanna River. You go over the bridge and then you exit, and it looks like you're going to just drive right into the river. And all of a sudden, here's this little island, which is mostly a baseball park, beautiful park. And we were sitting watching a game, and it had rained earlier in the day and discouraged a lot of people who might have gone to that game, so it was not a full house. And as we watched the game, and my brother-in-law became sort of more and more enchanted by the game going on in front of us, I turned to him at one point and I said, "You only played 1 year in professional baseball," and he'd always told me before that his curse was that they tried to turn him into a power hitter. He was an outfielder who was really a contact hitter and a very fast base runner, and they tried to turn him into a power hitter, and they ruined his swing. And then he got released at the end of his 1 year. And I said to him, if it had happened another way, if you had gotten every break, if you'd had coaches who really recognized your strengths and let you build on them rather than trying to turn you into a different kind of hitter, how high could you have gone? Now, he played in the old Western Carolina League, which was about as low as the minor leagues go, lower than they go now. And he looked at me with absolutely clear eyes, no irony in them, and he said, "I could have played in the big leagues." And I'm sure that almost everybody who's ever played and signed a contract, played well enough to sign a contract, believes that they could have. And I like to believe that he could have, and I think he could have. I saw him, of course, much later as a, still a very good athlete. but that dream never dies. And I think that's one of the things that carries baseball. You know, unless you weigh 280 pounds, you can't say, I could have played in the National Football League. And unless you're 6'10", you can't say, I could have played in the National Basketball Association. But you can be a normal-sized guy and have some skills, and you can dream about playing in the big leagues.
Yeah. You write a little about the minor leagues in baseball days. For some people, the minor leagues are like the last bastion of the true spirit of baseball without the commercialism and the TV cameras and everything. And for other people, it's just like the tacky, low-budget version of baseball. So which is it for you?
Oh, it's a marvelous combination of both. On the one hand, it's good baseball. I mean, AA, for example, that game that I saw in Harrisburg with my brother-in-law was a terrific game, and everybody on both teams was on their way up. You know, every kid, as I said, was dreaming of playing in the big leagues, and it was great fun to try and spot the kids who might have a shot. On the other hand, tacky doesn't begin to describe some of the things that happen in minor league parks. They are trying to make a dollar. And so you got the dynamite lady who packages herself in a cardboard box at home plate and blows herself up at a different minor league park every night. You got all these crazy promotional stunts where if you turn to page 13 in your program and your number matches the one that the PA announcer reads off, you get a free ice cream cone at the Dairy Queen or $5 worth of dry cleaning at Sid's. You know, I mean, it goes on and on. Between every inning, you get this stuff, and it's very schlocky and silly. But the hot dogs are hot and the beer is cold, and on a nice night, there's no better place to be.
So you're going to be watching the game tonight?
I'll watch it for as long as I can stay awake. I hate to admit it, but it's hard for me. I have a day job, you know. I'm a college teacher at Curry College out in Milton, Massachusetts, as well as a sports writer and a book writer. And the day job sometimes dictates that I actually go to sleep before the World Series games are over.
Bill Littlefield is the author of Baseball Days and a book of profiles for young people called Champions.